Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. For my American audience, it's Thanksgiving weekend, so my best to you and your families. For the international audience, you don't celebrate Thanksgiving, but it gives me the opportunity to thank you for making Word Balloon one of your podcasting choices. I certainly appreciate it. Today we'll be talking to DC writer Mark Waid, who's been writing some great stuff for 52, the weekly series that keeps us all captivated, and has really done a great job revitalizing the Legion in Supergirl and the Legion of Superheroes. If there's one series in the DC Universe that always suffers any time continuity gets a reboot, it's usually the Legion of Superheroes. But it's good that they turn to a longtime Legion fan in Mark Waid to still give nods to a lot of the things that happened in the Legion's past and still put a lot of interesting new spins on characters and plot developments. And certainly adding Supergirl to the mix fills a void that I think has been there for a long time since losing one of the cornerstone members of the Legion, the Earth One Superboy. The great thing about a guy like Mark is he knows the DC Universe so well, and he can interject so many great little Easter eggs that really make a lot of us longtime fans really happy, and also take that knowledge that he has of the past and give us new interpretations and go into new directions that people might not have thought of before. That's what's going on right now in the current Legion of Superheroes book. If you don't pick it up, you're really missing out, and I urge you to make it one of your current choices. Our conversation begins with a look at Mark's view on the Legion of Superheroes. First of all, being such a hardcore DC guy like yourself, I think it's great having Supergirl back in the Legion.
Thank you.
Was that your pitch?
Actually, no. It was, the idea was to do something special to mark the one-year later event that DC was doing across its line with all its books. You know, the idea that there'd be some sort of major shakeup to the book, but since we were so new and fresh at that point, we'd only had about 15 issues under our belt. You know, we didn't want to do anything too terribly radical because we were still building the not only the team but also the universe around it. I mean, that's the upside to having the Legion as a team in the 31st century is that it really is off on its own, which allows you a lot more autonomy and creative freedom. But at the same time, when you do want to sort of tie into something else that DC is doing, some big marketing stunt or some big thing guaranteed to push all the books, then you've just got to work a little bit harder and come up with something a little more creative, because you can't just have, you know, Doomsday walking through or Lex Luthor show up. So we were talking about what to do, and we had a couple of ideas. None of them set us on fire. One of them was to make it Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes once more, but then a certain thing called Infinite Crisis was going to throw a wrench in that plan. So we went to Dan DiDio, not knowing the final fate of Superboy. We went to Dan DiDio and we said, what about Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes? And he came back with, what about Supergirl and the Legion of Superheroes? And I really have learned to like Supergirl. I didn't like her a whole lot when I was growing up, but I've really learned to appreciate the character and the differences that you can wring from that character now that she's been reestablished in the DC Universe. So that sounded like a great bet to me. And basically the offer was made to us, put her in the book, you know, figure out how she got there, and don't worry about giving her back until you're done. And that can be 6 months or 16 months or 6 years from now if you want, as long as you're telling good stories. And at some point in the future, we'll worry about how it jives up with the continuity in her own book. But for the time being, she's sort of taken, you know, out of time and put 1,000 years in the future, and then, you know, when somebody eventually puts her back in the 21st century, then she'll just go right back to, you know, in between Supergirl 8 and 9 or whatever it was.
Sure.
And pick up from there.
No, and that's the beauty of it, too, is that, yeah, you can be this moment in time that, yeah, she just gets put back in. And
yeah,
I just,
exactly. So we can put her back whenever we want. So, yeah.
And I love the fact that, especially initially, she's just like, you know, this is the craziest dream I've ever had, and I'm just enjoying kind of hanging out in this dream and enjoying this delusion of what 1,000 years from now might look like.
Well, it only made sense to me. I thought about what her time, you know, what her mindset would be like if she suddenly woke up 1,000 years in the future, and I didn't want to shift the focus of the book completely to, oh, my God, I'm trapped in the future. I've got to get back home. How do I get back home? Because then that becomes, you know, that becomes a thing that she's working on 24-7.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives her no, you know, I mean, it really doesn't allow for much else to happen in the Legion if they're trying to get her back to the 21st century all the time. So it's like I was thinking about it, and I thought that would, it only made sense to me. I mean, she's if you look at all she's been through already, her home world blew up, and she was stuffed in a rocket ship, and she landed on Earth, and suddenly she had these amazing powers that she didn't expect, and her cousin was all grown up, and everything was topsy-turvy, and then she was only here on Earth for like maybe less than a year, if that, and then suddenly catapulted once more, and this point in time waking up in the 31st century. I honestly, you know, having once more lost ties to everything that you know and everything that's familiar to you, I think it's a reasonable expectation that your brain would just shut down.
Yes.
That the only survival mechanism you would have in your psyche would be to just tell yourself, this is all a dream, and at some moment, at some point, the alarm clock's going to ring, and my dad's going to wake me up on my little Krypton bed, and I'm going to go back to school, and everything's going to be the way it was. So I may as well enjoy it, because, look, I get to fly in this dream, and I get to have heat vision, and I have to meet all these cool kids from the future who are weird and different colored and different shaped and have different powers, and yeah.
Supergirl's been kind of a hot potato in terms of writers and creators, and, you know, starting with Loeb, handing off very briefly with Rucka, Joe Kelly kind of finishing some of Rucka's ideas, and I know that Justin Gray and Palmiotti are going to come on for a brief interlude, and I don't even know who's following them.
I don't even know, to tell you the truth, but yeah, it really has been creatively very much a hot potato book.
So have you been coordinating with the Supergirl editor? Is that Berganza? Who is the editor?
Yeah. Oh, hell no. No. We just... Well, I mean, in a perfect world we would, but the deal we struck was, you know, we talked about, you know, courting it a lot more closely in the beginning when we weren't sure how long we were going to leave Supergirl in the 31st century, but now that it looks like she's going to be here a while, our coordination is pretty much, you know, the sort of mutual agreement that, hey, you guys can do whatever you want with her in the 31st century as long as we get her back in one piece someday.
The great thing is, I think, then, whatever the initial plan for Supergirl is, I mean, the character is remaining very consistent despite this hot potato mentality of other Supergirl writers, because, as you say, she's experiencing Earth as a very fresh environment, and now 31st century Earth as a very fresh environment.
Yeah, I think there's some consistency to it. I think there's some inconsistency in that. I think that I may view the character a little differently than some of the other writers, past or present, have. I tend to look at the character. Let me backtrack. To me, when you mention Supergirl, or when you talk to people about Supergirl, or when you're describing Supergirl, invariably the very first adjective that should come out of your mouth would be sweet. Mm-hmm. She's a sweet girl. I mean, it's, you know, she can have a lot of other stuff going on. She can have baggage if you want. Doesn't mean she has to be namby-pamby, and it doesn't mean she has to be not interesting, but she's sweet. So that's the foundation of the character in the 31st century, and I'm able to play with her a little, and she's a little, I think, a little less hard-edged and a little less street-savvy than they're playing her in her own monthly book.
Okay.
But again, the advantage that we have there is we can always just say, like, again, that's just character progression. This is a point in her life and a period in her life, and when we hand her back to the 21st century, she can have grown and changed. And besides, you know, we all know that people act differently depending upon who they're with. People act differently depending upon who else is around them, and she's going to just by nature be different around some of the harder-edged DC characters or whatever than she will in this futuristic fancy utopia that is Metropolis.
I love the fact, too, that you got Cosmic Boy, at least initially, kind of wondering, do I have a crush on her? What's going on? I mean, right. I'm having some sort of feelings with her, which is nice. It's a great change. I always loved the Supergirl Legion stories of the 60s and 70s and where it went. And even the weird, I mean, you think back now, and I mean, they're telling kids that, you know, can a woman love a robot? Sure, why not?
Sure, why not, exactly.
Didn't seem to be a problem for those guys. So it's nice to see the Cosmic Boy, at least for now, might be having the Jones, and who knows what, you know, you've got cooking as far as if, you know, Brainiac is going to suddenly, it's going to dawn on him.
Right.
But I think that's cool. And I mean, again, Mark, what I liked, and we said this in our first conversation when you took over the Legion, you know, you're like me, you're an old time DC fan that appreciates what came before in the Legion, and you're able to have echoes of that in this new interpretation of the team.
Right. With at the same time, without being wedded to it, without being chained down to it, to the point where, I mean, you know, people use that as an inspiration is the way to go rather than feel like you're bound to the letter of the law of things that happened 30 or 35 years ago.
And I also like the fact, too, that as usual, there's always the question of leadership in the team, and that's always a subplot. You know, this is kind of a team that, in one sense, is kind of a fun, free team, but they also have their own kind of, you know, little politics going on in the background, and I think we saw that in the most recent issue with, are you calling her Atom Girl? Is Shrinking Violet now Atom Girl?
Officially she's Atom Girl, but people tend to call her Shrinking Violet. The gag with that, for those who haven't read, is that for the first year of the book, we didn't show her at all. That she was just Atom Girl, the microscopic member of the team. And to anyone who joined the team after she joined, everyone just sort of assumed that she was a myth, that she was a hoax, like a shelf stretcher or whatever that you tell people to use when they start work at the hardware store, that sort of mythical prank superhero. So they just started calling her Shrinking Violet because they made up this big mythology about her that she must be really shy and stuff because they didn't believe she really existed. So you know, on the record, she's Atom Girl, but I like the name Shrinking Violet, and the other characters tend to call her Shrinking Violet. But yeah, regardless, she's sort of playing, the advisor to Shadow Lass, thinking perhaps, encouraging her. Maybe she should be looking at leadership. Maybe she should be looking at enlisting in the elections. And you'll see more of that in the coming couple of 3 months. You'll start to see other characters really debating about whether or not to put their hat in the ring as the next leader election comes up.
That's cool. It was very interesting, and it really did kind of smack of, like, city politics. As a guy from Chicago, that's kind of what it felt like to me, where she really was like, hey, you really got to think about leading. I mean, these are the things you believe. I thought that was an interesting wrinkle. All the different interpretations. A triplicate girl, man, she moves around. Now
she does move around.
She's with Element Lad now?
At least one of her is interested in Element Lad, so...
Well, that'll be an interesting problem if one is with Element Lad and another. Who did she go on the date with? Which one of them went on the date?
Sunboy she went on the date
with.
So, but, it's funny. I mean, it's true, and it will be interesting to see. And you know what? The thing is, you actually hit on something without giving anything away. You hit upon something very interesting, which is, there actually are going to be consequences to the notion that one of her is falling in love and two of them aren't.
Well, and even when they were looking for clues.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it is kind of interesting, and I think that's a very fertile, area that can go into a bunch of interesting directions, and it's nice to see that you're thinking that way, Mark, because I think you are taking these characters into directions that I don't think have been considered before, and I think that's terrific, given how, these characters have been around since the late 50s.
Cool, thank you. Well, a lot of that's Barry Kitson, too. A lot of it is the artist on the book, who, we knock the plots back and forth together, and he's all the time coming up with interesting bits of business or interesting bits of character stuff. And so, I'd be foolish to say I'm doing it on my own. So
that's cool. Well, you guys are a great team, and
I
really enjoyed your guys' run on Empire. And we all hope that sometime in the future, when the schedules allow, you guys will be able to go back to that world as well.
Yeah, we would love to. It's just a matter of eking the time out in our schedule. So.
No, I can appreciate that. Now, again, with Legion, very cool to see the 31st century version of Kandor, and a very harsh reality for Supergirl to contend with. Now, all of a sudden, the dream is kind of shattering, and it's kind of like Kara in the snake pit right now.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Which is great. I mean, and of course, I don't want to tip it because it's a current issue, but the last page in the current issue, folks, if you haven't checked it out, it looks like a Legionnaire might be coming back very soon, and it's one that... I think a lot of us have been waiting for a long time.
Me particularly, because I love that particular character. So, and that's a huge development for the next couple, 3 months. So.
Outstanding. It continues to be a very fun book that I think old-time fans can really appreciate, and I think new-time fans will enjoy the journey as well, because, what you knew about the Legion in the past might inform some of the tricks that you like to play in terms of tweaking things. But really, all bets are off in terms of what these new 31st century characters represent. How are the older Legion fans? They are probably the most contentious group, or among the most contentious groups in comic fans in terms of reboots. And in fairness, they've suffered a lot of reboots because with Crisis and all the various times that the whole DCU has to have been rebooted, one of the first things to go is Legion continuity.
Right.
So, what has been the reaction?
I think it's been overall positive. I think that, there's still a huge number of people who are going to be unhappy that that's not their Legion, that this is not their Legion, or that this. And I feel for them. I really do. I mean, nothing would please me more than tomorrow than to go down to the comic shop and pick up a brand new issue of Adventure Comics starring the Legion with Kurt Swan and Jim Shooter working on it. That would make me the happiest boy on earth. So I feel for that. But at the same time, you know, a lot of that water has already passed under the bridge. Even if we wanted to go back to, old continuities and old storylines from the 60s and 70s, there's just no way, because so much else has changed in the DC universe that it would make it another hodgepodge patchwork. I think that's kind of where we missed the boat with Legion, is every time we've rebooted in the past, we keep trying to throw a patch on stuff. We keep trying to work as hard as we can to make our first priority to be to try to restore it as much to the previous continuity as we possibly can. It becomes like a big mad rush to try to replicate what has come before, instead of just taking the basic foundation of the book, the basic foundation of the concept, and then moving it forward and trying to come up with new threats and new villains and new characterizations, and leave the other stuff where it is. I mean, my Legion archives are still going to be there on the shelf, no matter what I write, you know? I'll still be able to delve back in that stuff and enjoy it, so.
Are there any showcase plans for any of those old Legion runs?
I don't know, but man, there ought to be. I can't imagine there wouldn't be at some point in the near future, because they're doing so with us. Those showcases apparently are going gangbusters.
I'm not surprised. It's fun, and being a guy that, you know, did grow up on all the Silver Age stuff yourself, it's great to read those stories again and get them at an affordable price. The hardcover things are fantastic, but not everyone can, you know, drop, you know, $50 per book.
Right.
And so it's nice to see something under $20 that, you know, is kind of a fun way to look back and enjoy those stories again.
I would hope there'd be some Legion ones. I haven't heard anything one way or another, but I can't imagine that Legion is not very high on the list of priorities.
Has Paul Levitz commented on your Legion run, Paul having such a long history with the Legion himself?
Pleasantly, yes. Paul sent me a nice note about issue 6 or 7 or so, just out of the blue, just a nice note, just, you know, thanking me for what he just read and just some encouraging words, and that was very pleasant to read. That was very, you know, I really wanted his blessing on this, because I'm not interested in doing it if Paul's not into what we're doing, because, you know, Paul's written more Legion stories than anybody else on Earth, and he knows the characters better, and, you know, it's not just that he's the publisher, it's also he's like the world's biggest Legion fan, so if you get a nice note from Paul, it goes a long way.
That's really cool. Let's talk about 52.
Okay.
You know, we're at the halfway point, and at our conversation, I believe 27 just came out.
Right.
So, at this point, a great issue, by the way.
Thank you.
Individually, yeah. Ralph Dibny's story, The Elongated Man, has become a very interesting journey, much in the same way that Brad Meltzer had him on an interesting little path in Identity Crisis as well. And I think, you know, he's the last guy that I think you would think would be toying around with the Helmet of Fate and just kind of going on this very tortured path of, you know, trying to figure out a way of bringing his wife back to life. A very dark story for a very bright character.
It's a very dark story. I mean, the whole concept was, let's, you know, here's a man of science. I mean, he's a character from the stable of editor Julie Schwartz. Therefore, he is all about science and all about logic, and he's up in a detective, and he's just, it's all about the human mind, and to him, there's the possible and there's the impossible. And to have him interface with the world of magic, use him as the lens through which we examine how magic works in the DC Universe now, has given us a great number of stories out of it. And we've gotten a lot of good material out of it. So, yeah, being able to use Ralph as the lens through which we see how the world of magic works in the DC Universe, you know, how magic works in the DCU, has given us opportunity for a lot of great stories and great viewpoints, and so we've been really lucky there that the character has managed to sustain his own story when it's not a character that a lot of fans would have taken very seriously.
Now, are you guys? It's funny because I think, based on what people have written before, fans have the presumption of saying, "Well, certainly a lot of what's going on in the Rene Montoya story must be coming from Greg Rucka. A lot of what's happening with Black Adam and the Black Marvels must be coming from Jeff Johns, given his association with JSA. I almost think that Ralph is kind of your story. Am I wrong in thinking that you know, and again, not to say that the other three aren't contributing.
Right.
But you know, are you? Is it? Can I ask you which? I mean, I guess I can ask you. It's a question of are you going to answer and say? I mean, can you point to corners of the 52 story that you know started with you?
I think that I mean, or not so much started with me, but certainly the, you know, carrying that particular football of the six plot lines. I've been doing a lot of the carrying on the Ralph stuff, but. You know, others have stepped in to do this chapter or that chapter of it. We still talk, even though we're about 45, 46 issues in, we've only got a few weeks left to go on our end.
Okay.
You know, we still talk religiously on the phone every week, and we knock ideas back and forth and have our plot conferences and talk in depth about how to break things up and how to, who does what and who does this sequence and who does that sequence. And so we've all had our hands in that, you know, with that character for some time, as we have all of them. I mean, I think that... with the exception of Rene Montoya, which, of course, is Greg's stuff, duh. we've all sort of passed the other characters around at one point or another just for fun, because we've, you know, if nothing else, because we want to be able to say we've, you know, we all had something to do with all of it.
Has it been exciting to then get a chapter back and have, you know, Ralph put in a certain place or one of your ideas come back in a different spin?
Because yeah, Grant and or luckily Jeff did something not in different? A bad spin. There's never been a point where stuff's come back and I've thought, oh, that's not what I would have done, and that's bad. There are times when I look at it and go, well, that's not what I had in mind or what I would have done, but, man, that's great, and it gives us more stuff to launch off of. There's a whole sequence with Ralph coming up in Nanda Parbat that, to be honest, is a lot of Grant, because if you're going to be talking about mystic revelations, you know, that's the guy to go to.
Go to the shaman. Absolutely.
Right. So, you know, so I get these pages back, and I'm thinking, well, wow, this isn't what I would have done, but damn if it doesn't work.
But Grant's been on the mountain with dead man, so he knows.
Yeah, Ralph, you know, Grant has a regular audience with Ramakrishna every month anyway, so I'm sure in his case it was just transcription more than actually writing, so...
And by the way, a few weeks ago, too, and I guess it's been several weeks now, but that one moment when in the resurrection of Kal-El, when you know, Ralph really came close to seeing the straw woman turn into Sue, and just him clutching that scarecrow at the end, that was great. And just dark and creepy, and it's like, wow, that was... That's the great thing about, I think, 52 in general is... the great surprises that you guys continue to show, and it's funny to see the reaction of people, and people are really, oh God, that would never happen or whatever, and it's like, why not? I think I'm enjoying the roller coaster. I think it's fantastic.
Good. I'm glad you're digging it. I mean, the characters have to work to extremes. They're not interesting if they're not working to extremes. As long as they're staying within their basic concepts of who the characters are, and as long as they're behaving true to their personalities. And I think in Ralph's case in particular, as you get near the end of his story, we're going to pull back some reveals and some interesting things that have been going on for the past year or so, or the past 27 weeks or so that you haven't realized are going on. And I think that's going to, you know, I think when you are able to look at Ralph's story on the whole or some of these other character stories in the big picture, I think you'll be pleasantly surprised that, even in some of the more outrageous cases, they're acting a lot more true to form than you may think right now.
There's a real television aspect to this story as well. And I guess a lot of comic book events eventually do spawn their own series from these events. And I think some readers might, you know, feel like, I can see this becoming an ongoing series once 52 is done. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, which series do spring from 52. And if they're as obvious now halfway through the story as they might, you know, as opposed to what they might be when the story finishes.
Right, and I bet they're not. I bet they're not, because I think people are going to be quite surprised at, you know, who makes their way out of the other side of 52, if anyone. So, because again, none of those characters have surfaced since, you know, I mean, 52 takes place in that pocket year, you know, of the DC Universe that they just skipped over. And none of those characters have shown up in the DC Universe since, and won't until 52 is over with, so... You know, clearly some of them didn't make it out, or if they did, where have they been for the last 52 weeks? You know, those questions arise. So I think people are going to be pleasantly – there are plans to spin things out of 52, obviously. It would be foolish not to, because we've had some great characters and some great revelations and some great character moments. But I think there's going to be quite a bit of surprise as to who walks out on the other side.
There have been great cameos in it as well. I mean, from Ambush Bug and that one-shot, one-mission JLA – appearance from a couple of weeks ago, to even a little interlude with the Super Chief, which I thought was great. And, man, I got to tell you again, as an old-time DC reader, how cool it was when the older Native American grandfather opens up the chest and you saw that great bison mask of Super Chief. I'm like, man, there's somebody I haven't seen in, 30 years.
Yeah, man, none of us knew where that came from. Grant sent those pages in.
No kidding.
Then we were all like, man, what the hell? Grant, I guarantee you Jeff and Greg have never even heard of Super Chief. what the hell is this? But, then Grant gets on the phone and does it and explains what his, where he was coming from and what his notion on that was, and it all made sense, and it all ties into the big picture. So, bully for him. We do talk about things in great detail, and we do, arc out a lot of the stories in conjunction with each other. But that said, still, 2 weeks later, when it's just you and a keyboard at 2 a.m, and you've got your notes on what you talked about, but then another idea suddenly comes to mind that's even better, or, tells the same story overall, but is a more effective way of telling it, or some new character that is a more interesting way of doing it, then, you run with it. That's the way we've always been encouraged to run with it. And the thing that most surprises me is that none of us have gone down a false path for any real length of time. I mean, no one yet has turned in, the big 6-page sequence with character A or character B that we all look at and go, oh, you know what, this is not, I appreciate that you're on your little flight of fancy here, but this doesn't really work in terms of the bigger picture. Instead, we still all seem to be very much on the same wavelength, and so we all are constantly surprising each other with our material as we swap pages back and forth, and that's part of the fun of it too, frankly, is you want the other three guys to go, wow, good one, you raised the bar, and now I gotta beat that tomorrow. But that said, we don't, no one yet has fumbled, which amazes me. I can't believe that none of us yet have pitched and written up a scene for an upcoming issue that we all look at under cold eyes and go, ew, it doesn't work. So far, so good.
Well, and your background, being a former editor and working with all the writers that you have as an editor in the past, and now working on something like 52 as a co-writer, do you see a time? I've seen other examples at DC and Marvel where you kind of got co-writers. Jeff is doing it a lot, Jeff Johns, with several DC writers. We see it a lot at Marvel as well. Do you see yourself possibly having that kind of role in the future? Obviously not with something as large and weekly as 52, but any type of monthly where you might co-write with somebody else in the future?
We've talked about it. It's entirely possible, and I would like that because there's ups and downs. I mean, there's pluses and minuses to it. The plus is that it's just always more fun to jam with somebody else.
Sure.
And I enjoy that. I enjoy the editorial part of it where I'm able to, say, work with somebody who is younger and newer and fresher and has, more vital ideas that aren't as, that haven't been beaten out of him by the weight of time like mine have. But but at the same time, there would be perhaps a level of craft that I could bring to it that would make it a good team. The only downside of that is that no matter how many times I've collaborated in the past, what I found is that just because you're doing half the work doesn't mean just because you're doing half the issue doesn't mean you're doing half the work. Like you're still doing, more than half the work, both of you are, because I can't just think of 11 pages of a story and then just let it go. I can't write 11 pages without kind of knowing what the 22 pages are altogether. Even if it's collaboration, you still got to always keep the biggest, the bigger picture in mind. And otherwise, it would be much easier. And again, that's one of the things that's been rewarding but crippling with 52 is that it's, yes, technically it's really only 13 issues worth of material, give or take, from each of us, which over the course of a year isn't that much, but we've got to keep our eye on the ball at all times.
Right.
At all times we've got to be up on what everybody else is doing, and it's not a whole lot less work than if any of us were writing all of 52 all by ourselves.
Wow. Well, that's an achievement then. And I mean, it seems, congratulations for all of you guys, including guys on the production end that have been able to keep this thing on schedule and on time every week.
Oh man, those guys just rock. Those guys, we turn in our scripts and we try our best to do, to beat the deadlines or meet the deadlines the best we can, but, we'd be nowhere without, clearly, without Keith Giffen doing the breakdowns
yep.
to give the artist, and B, without Steve Wacker, the original editor, and Mike Seclane, the new editor, and Harvey Richards and Janine Schaefer and all the other fine people who've worked on the book on behind the scenes and in production, who make sure that it's out, which is, you know, and comes out on time, which is pretty amazing.
Was it a tough transition losing Steve?
It was a huge transition losing Steve, unfortunately. I mean, it was, Steve built the machine, you know, and Steve was the guy who kept the energy up when it was flagging, and Steve was always there to, you know, talk about it and talk about it excitingly and, you know, with enthusiasm. And he just kind of knew how to finesse us because he was there at the ground floor. So he was, you know, he was down, he's at the foundation of the whole process. So by now he knows how to work with each of us individually and how to get the best work out of us. And his replacement, Michael Seclane, is learning much faster than any human being has a right to be expected to learn. He's doing a great job. And it hasn't impacted the book in any way. I think that, you know, I feel for Mike because Mike's put in 16-hour days, 7 days a week, literally, just working on this and trying to get up to speed and trying to get us all, you know, keep us all in the groove. And it's hard because we all loved Steve and we all very much saw this as something that Steve contributed as much to as all of us. So, I mean, that said, Michael's still doing, as good a job, if not better, than anyone could have expected, and we're lucky to have him. And I'm glad we do, and I can't say enough good things about Michael, but, boy, we miss Steve.
Fair enough. Let's talk about the two-page origin stories, because those are tough.
No kidding.
Well, yeah, and I appreciate you saying that. I don't think readers understand how tough it must be to cram an origin into two pages, and especially, I mean, God, this is something that I don't think, you know, has been seen in comics since really the Silver Age, in terms of, like something like Super Turtle or something like that, that, you know, fill in two pages and give me something that makes sense and is entertaining. And I congratulate you because you're working with a bunch of all-star artists, but you've got to really boil this thing down into, you know, just a few panels.
Man, you know, I've got to say, I mean, it's a fun job and I love it and I wouldn't trade it and all that good stuff, but boy, it's a bitch. It really, even for somebody who knows the stuff pretty well like I do, my God, distill the origin of Hawkman and Hawkgirl into six panels. Good luck. And, you know, make sure that the characters are named, make sure that their location is named, make sure that everything essential that you need to know about the character is in there, and deciding what is essential about the character, you know. The best example right off the bat was the Wonder Woman origin, and I was very pleased with the way that came together, and Adam Hughes drew it, and it looked beautiful, and I thought this is a great one to lead off with, and I was very pleased with it, and then immediately the fan reaction, the backlash was, you know, well, you mentioned A, B, C, D, and E, but you didn't mention the invisible plane, therefore the invisible plane doesn't exist anymore, therefore you're changing the origin, and I'm trying to, you know, calm everybody down, going, no, I had six panels. Six panels. There's still an invisible plane. It's just, it's not the most important part, and it's, if you've got six panels, you got to pick and choose, and everybody, you know, obviously everybody's going to be an armchair editor, and I would be too if I were sitting in their seat. I would probably cherry pick slightly different moments for the characters, but at the end of the day, you know, that the task is to come up with five or six panels worth of stuff that, and not overload it with captions and not overload it with dialogue and make it, you know, accessible and try to give you, when possible, something new or interesting about the character that you didn't know before. But in the cases of, you know, the big name characters, it's really hard to do because you don't want to suddenly shoehorn some factoid in there that is going to stand out like a sore thumb, that therefore then, you know, the next writer who comes along and does, say, Green Lantern is going to ignore, and therefore it's no longer canonical. I mean, the trick with the origins too is to try to concentrate on the stuff that is not going to change, the stuff that is going to make them iconic stories, so that you're not getting so much into the minutia of, you know, who was in the Teen Titans at this exact moment in time, or who was, you know, where was Steve Trevor in all this, a little stuff like that. So, and again, trying to keep it consistent with the characters, but more than that, trying to make sure that it's a good definition of who the character is. And when I approach them, I always ask myself, why they do what they do. And I think that's an important question to answer within the context of that origin. And it's a question that you don't get in a Who's Who page. You know, or an answer you don't get in a Who's Who page. You get a lot of facts and a lot. But I want to give more of the sense of the character's personality and who they are and why they do what they do and what their motivations are and who they are as people on top of their origins and on top of their powers.
Who's editing these origins?
Steve was and then Michael is now. And,
okay.
And Janine Schaefer is also basically taking point on them. And basically, you know, at this point, just we go back and forth. And we pretty much, by now, this late in the game, we pretty much got the laundry list of characters down as to who's going to be in the book. Obviously, the principals of 52 need to be there, and you'll see them as the thing progresses. But obviously, Superman and Batman need to show up. And,
sure.
You know, it's I think not all the choices will be the most obvious ones, because I'm sure there'll be a place for us to keep doing two-page origins in the DC Universe once 52 is over with. At least that's what we're trying to find a place for. You know.
Okay.
And with that in mind, that kind of took the pressure off of us of making sure that, say, well, you know, Aquaman's a good example. Aquaman would be an incredibly difficult character to do an origin of at this exact moment in time. Because of everything that's going on in his book and everything that we know is going to start happening in his book soon.
Okay.
That we run the risk of, with certain characters. Captain Marvel is another good example.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way to do a definitive origin of Captain Marvel and the Marvel family right now without either having it take place before the events of Trial of Shazam, which makes it immediately outdated,
right?
Or leap forward to the end of Trials of Shazam, which means we've given away their miniseries.
Sure.
So some of them, you know, characters like that, we just can't do origins on because the timing is not right. So that's why you get to see characters that you might not otherwise expect, like Wildcat or the Metal Men.
Well, I'm happy to see them, quite frankly, and I think that is one of the great things about 52 is dusting off characters that have become third and fourth tier characters just because they haven't been used lately, and it's so nice to see them back. It's great to see that Brad is using the Metal Men in the Justice League Red Tornado story that he's got going on. And you know, and I love the whole Doc Magnus and the Mad Scientist aspect of 52, because not only is it great seeing Doc kind of getting center stage and also seeing a very frail Doc Magnus. I didn't remember was it invented for 52, the psychosis that he's going through?
No. It was invented by Steve Gerber back in the 70s when they did the Metal Man series back then.
Wow.
That Doc had a mental breakdown, and you know a lot of the stuff with the pills today, and the stuff that you know stuff we're adding with 52 in terms of his medication and how he deals with it. But the whole notion that you know there's you have to be a little unbalanced to be that brilliant was something that Gerber came through with in the 70s, and we just kind of run with that ball because we all love that era of Metal Men.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Before I let go of the origins,
yeah.
Are you getting the artists that you guys want?
Oh, God, yeah. I can't believe the guys we're getting. And we've had, you know, and we still have a couple of Brian Bolland pieces to come up.
Yeah.
We still have a couple of Adam Hughes pieces coming up.
Cool.
Bolland in particular just said, I'll do whatever you guys want me to do.
That's fantastic.
So
there's a guy that can't do a 22-page book, but can come in for 2 pages to do an
perfect
origin.
Perfect for that stuff, exactly. So you know, his stuff has been phenomenal. The Kubert brothers are in on their respective characters, Superman and Batman.
Neil Adams going to do anything for this?
I would love for him to. We begged for him to do Green Arrow, and apparently his timing just wouldn't work out.
That's too bad.
But I would. I think there's still room for him. I mean, there's still a couple of things there's still a couple of characters that he would be absolutely spot on perfect for, and all the assignments have not yet been made, so there's still that chance.
Get Mike Grell for Green Arrow then.
Mike Grell also would have been great for Green Arrow. Actually, I think we got Scott McDaniel actually because he's doing the
other
book.
Yeah, that's cool.
But in a lot of cases we were lucky enough to get the guys who were doing the regular ongoing books.
Sure.
And in cases where it's not those assignments haven't been pinned down or they're not definitive, then you know, we're able to go off on more on flights of fancy, like having Kevin Nolan come in and do some of the Carmen Infantino characters. So.
Oh, that's cool. That's great.
Yeah.
Now, you know, again, when we first spoke, 52 was just, you know, it hadn't come out yet, and it was still in its beginning stages. And you were telling me how there were characters that you never had a handle on, but in talking to other creators, and you used Adam Hughes, actually, as a specific example, that a conversation with Adam Hughes about Wonder Woman made you understand Wonder Woman in a way that you never had before.
Yep.
Have there been any characters since working on 52 where you're like, wow, I never thought about it before, but now that I've actually touched these characters, I'd really like to write a series about X?
I would. I mean, I never thought about, you know, I never thought about Doc Magnus much and the Metal Men much until this, but now I think we're all sort of like fighting for a chance to do that. I mean, the sad thing is, I think if you asked all of us the same question who are writing 52, we'd all have the same answers, and then we'd all sort of been, you know, we're all sort of jockeying for a position on those characters when it's all over with. But yeah, you know, I'm also reminded how much I would love to do Metamorpho. I was also reminded how much I'd love to do a Green Arrow book. I mean, just as you get a chance to play with some of these characters, they're all so much fun. They're all good. You know, there are no sucky characters at DC, just sucky execution sometimes because they're given to people who don't get them.
Yes.
So, or people who get them but, you know, maybe love them a little too much. I don't know, sometimes. So it's a fine line.
Well, that's what I was wondering, too, because in both mainstream companies where there are established name heroes, a lot of times I'm seeing it both at DC and Marvel where recently the idea is, hey, you know, it's great to see this adventurer, but instead of going back and telling more stories of a male version of this, let's turn it into a woman. I mean, we're seeing that now at Marvel with the White Tiger is going to be a woman now. At JSA, they flirted with the idea of a new Crimson Avenger, and all of a sudden the Crimson Avenger is a woman. Certainly in 52, it's the arrows are pointing to Montoya picking up the mantle of the Question. And I wonder if, you know, I as much as I can appreciate, and I think there is always more room for more female superheroes, and I think that's great, I also wonder if, you know, maybe the wrong writer isn't getting, or the wrong writer is getting a chance at a male character, doing it wrong, and the decision is being made, you know, that doesn't work anymore, let's make it into a woman, and maybe it'll work that way.
I guess possible. I think that, I don't know where, I grant your point in that that does seem to be the go-to for both companies right now. If, when in doubt, change the gender.
Yeah.
And clearly, and by the way, there's not enough of that going the other way. You know, I think the next Black Widow ought to be some 6 foot tall blonde guy or
a dude.
Yeah, the DC's new Black Canary, a man in fishnets.
Yeah, no, please.
So there's not enough of that going around. But I'm not sure I can speak to that. I mean, it's a good point. It's a valid point. Sometimes it really works. I think, you know, clearly there's been more issues of Manhunter now, you know,
yes,
than there ever were in any incarnation before that.
Sure.
Added together, so.
No, and that's fair. That's a good example of one that I think, it, you know, has the potential to work. And
right.
I think Mark Andreyko is doing a great job. And
yes,
that's a good example that is working.
And sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. I think it at the end of the day, we just have to wait and let history let us, you know, decide for us whether it works or not.
No, that's cool. That's cool. I mean, and I'll even say, and I'll admit, this is my little fanboy moment and everything. I love the Question. I love Vic Sage. I also love Renee Montoya.
Yes.
And it's funny because I'm of the belief, too, that not every hero has to wear a mask. And
right.
I think Renee Montoya is a hero. And
yeah,
I think
she doesn't, exactly. She doesn't have to wear a cape and a domino mask and drive a cool car. I mean, she's a hero regardless.
Exactly. And that's the thing. It's like, and she's such an interesting character. And I also think there's a need, and I think the good writers understand this, as a counterbalance to the capes. I think you need a lot of just ordinary humans to be there in the story to kind of provide a different perspective and represent us in a different way,
yeah,
than the heroes can, and just be an average person. And again, be like Jim Gordon is never going to be a bigger hero than what he is as the police commissioner of Gotham City.
Right, and no one wants to see Jim Gordon put on a cape. No one. Right. No one. So, yeah.
Although he did back in the 50s, you know that.
I know,
that.
He was Mystery Man, I know.
Attaboy.
A bad choice on the part of, you know, another month where the script is due and nobody has an idea, so.
That's the great thing about talking to you, Mark, because you understand. I mean, you've read the history. You know all this stuff.
Yeah.
Do you think newer readers, how well is this stuff working? Because I think 52 is just, you know, great candy, great Easter eggs for any longtime DC reader. I think every time, you know, somebody does make a cameo that you haven't thought of, like Super Chief, for decades, when they appear, we're all just laughing and stuff. But I wonder about, you know, kids and stuff. Do you think they're responding well to the story and enjoying some of these weird little things that pop in?
I hope so. I mean, I do know that we made a really concentrated effort with the first couple of issues in particular to make sure that all the characters were brought on stage in such a way where you understood who they were and you understood why they do what they do and their backstories without really having to know anything about them. I do feel that you could hand those 27 issues of 52 so far to anybody, and they would still get a good story out of it. Whether they would catch it, whether they would pick up on all the little Easter eggs is a different story altogether, and probably not. But, you know, that said, you know, I didn't come into Buffy until four seasons in, and I enjoyed it, and it's only after I went back and looked at the first three seasons that I see that, you know, all the ancillary stuff I was missing. So, but it doesn't mean I didn't enjoy it. So, and everybody, I'm sure, has examples like that. I think so. I think people still get who these characters are and where they're coming from and get a sense of where they're going and get caught up in their dramas. I don't know what else we could have done to make it clearer who they were, but I'm hoping. I mean, again, there's also going to be a number of people who just aren't going to read it because they just assume they're going to have to know a lot about DC history.
Sure.
When that's frankly not the case. So, but there's, you know, all you can do is at the end of the day is sit down and try to do a good story and hope for the best.
Now, you mentioned Buffy, and I'm glad you did because it makes me think of current TV. Are you watching Heroes?
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's cool. Don't worry. I'll, if you want, we can stop so you'll be able to watch it. I don't want to mess you up.
No, that's, I'm, again, you know.
Oh, that's right. You're 2 hours earlier. So
West Coast and HD, you know, DVR. So, yeah, I love that show. I don't love every thread, but... And I'm sure that there, likewise, there's not everybody who, you know, everybody who reads 52 is not always in love with Ralph Dibny or Steel as they are with some of the other characters. But like everybody, I've got my favorites, although everybody knows the hero is the troop star of the show.
Absolutely.
But, man, even the stuff that, even the threads that aren't as interesting to me are still interesting to watch. It's a fun show.
The cheerleader, I expected to not like that story, and I am so pleased with how cool the actress is really pulling that off. And I've really, like, immediately did it, like, within the first couple episodes. I'm like, man, she is really great.
Yeah.
And it's such a fun story watching her go. And I'll say, I'm enjoying it. I agree with you. I think there are some threads that I'm not crazy about. But it's great, and I'm so pleased that it's doing as well as it is.
Yeah, me too. That it's really...
It could have been Misfits of Science.
Yeah, exactly. It's you know, it's good for comics. It just is a reminder that you don't have to have capes and master it all the work.
Absolutely. And, of course, you're exploring that world as well in Top Cow with Hunter Killer.
Yeah, true, exactly. Again, it's, as a matter of fact, it's in some ways, I see it the last couple of episodes, it's spookily similar in some ways.
Yes, it is.
Not that anyone's ripped this off, just saying that there's only so much ground you can cover there. There's going to be some overlap. If I were J. Michael Straczynski, I would certainly have my lawyers on the phone, but that's another story.
No, I hear you. Has Hollywood tapped your shoulder, Mark?
Oh, yeah, many a time, and it's been very pleasant and somewhat lucrative, but...
Attaboy.
But at the same time, yeah, I dig doing comics, I really do, and what the advantage I have about being out here in Hollywood and doing work on TV and film and animation is that all of them are media that I can turn away from if I want. I mean, I still have my comics job, I still have my day job, and it pays well enough to sustain, so... If I go in meetings on TVs or movie stuff, or TV stuff or movie stuff, and I don't like what's being pitched, I don't like what's, you know, or if people are trying to take out options on things like Empire or Hunter Killer, and I think they're crap, then I can just say, listen, thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to go back to writing comics.
Sure.
And that gives me a lot of freedom out here. So I've been very lucky to hitch on to a few things. Hopefully some announcements, you know, will be made in the next few months about certain options and certain other things I'm involved with, but we'll see.
Well, that's cool. I hope the guys upstairs are going to you as much as they are some of the other writers at DC, Warner Brothers, and really trying to kind of develop some of your ideas and some of your plots. I want to ask about The Flash, and I know they just made the announcement today that Mark Guggenheim is taking over for Bilson and DeMeo. And do you see yourself coming back to Bart Allen anytime soon, given that you really gave that first jump, you know, start to the character?
I really don't. I think that having loved that character deeply, and having created it with Umberto and with Mike Ringo, mm-hmm. I still think it's a good character. It's just Bart's gone through so many permutations and so much maturing and so much character development over the years that I think he's a great character. I think he's a good Flash, but he's not my idea of who he was. So it's like seeing an old girlfriend who's, 5 years later, who's married to somebody else and has a kid, and you still want to catch up every once in a while, but that doesn't mean you want to be a part of their lives anymore. So,
well, that's interesting because, look at Marv Wolfman going back to Nightwing, and I think in a lot of ways, I know Nightwing fans are certainly, relieved and saying, oh, finally, a guy who understands. I love Dick Grayson. I think he's a great character. And I just think it is interesting, and it was fun to see, even in the most recent issue, Nightwing has a conversation with Alfred, and there's Dick Grayson having a phone conversation with Alfred. And it just rang so true, and it's like, wow, that was cool. I can't remember the last time I really heard these two characters speak to each other in the hands of a writer who really understood the characters as well as he does. I think that's interesting. And I respect what you're saying, but yeah, it's cool because I would wonder that an older Bart, and the changes that he's gone through. Yeah, it's interesting that it would intrigue some writers, but I can appreciate too you saying, no, I liked Impulse the way he was, and Impulse stories.
It's not in any way a pejorative statement. It's not a petulant or defensive statement. It's because I think what's been done with the character in Teen Titans was great. I think that what's been done with him in Flash has been interesting, and I just don't. And yet, he doesn't feel like the Bart Allen I know anymore, and that makes sense. I mean, I'm actually proud of the fact that the character has been able to grow, grow in the DC universe and mature and take on different roles. And I still feel like I get to be a part of that, but. It's like my little bird has left the nest. boy, that's just the sappiest thing ever.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean.
I wish him the best of luck, and that he's moved on to other venues. Again, it's like the old girlfriend thing. It's just
sure.
So
no, I respect that, and of course, we all want to see you writing Barry. In an All-Star Flash story, then
someday. Yeah. It would be fun someday.
I'm hip. We'll wait. We got time.
All right.
We'll be there when it happens. I think that's great. Well, I think it's a slam dunk when it happens, man. I really do. And it's just because of your handle on the character. When you've touched on the character, even when it wasn't Barry, like in the case of the Return of Barry Allen, that wonderful story that you wrote, and also your take on Wally. And, of course, we still have to find out what happened to Wally.
Right.
And I look forward to that, and, I'll just leave it at that, and whatever.
Yeah, we do know. I mean, we do know what happened to Wally. It's just that you don't know yet, but we know, and it's a lot more interesting. It's a lot more interesting and mysterious than I think you think it is. So,
that's cool.
There you go.
Very quickly, any other of the new TV shows or movies that you're enjoying that kind of spill into the world of comic books?
Legion of Superheroes cartoon, I think, rocks. I really do. I love this cartoon. I love the fact that I'm watching Legion last. Did you watch it this past week?
I did not watch. I've only seen two.
I gotta say, the first one was not great. The second one was really not great. But with the third one, they kicked into high gear, and now they're doing a lot more cameos, and it's fun. There's cameos by Ultra Boy and Matter Eater Lad and so forth in the most recent one that aired. And they're clearly having a lot of fun with the Legion tapestry and the Legion mythos. I'm really enjoying that.
Would you have a chance to write any of that for them?
If and when they go to second season, I've been asked if I'd participate, and I'm sure, if they do, I'd love to join in if we can make it work out.
Very cool. I know you're a big fan of Galactica. Have you enjoyed what it's been?
Oh, my God, yes. Although still, nothing beats Doctor Who, still.
Yeah. Have you watched Torchwood?
I've loved Torchwood.
I finally saw a couple episodes, and I think it's really cool. Yeah.
I'm up through about episode four, and I'm flabbergasted. It's not I don't love it as much as I love Doctor Who, just because there was a wackiness and a sense of humor that was in the Doctor Who stuff, particularly the Eccleston year. But I really like Torchwood.
That's cool. And I finally saw the David Tennant episode from last season where Sarah Jane pops in.
Yeah,
and K-9, and it's nice the way that they're reaching back and embracing what happened in the old Doctor Who, and making it work much in the same way you guys are doing at DC with what worked in the past, and spinning it in a way for today's audience.
Right, without having to be. I mean, I've never seen an episode of Doctor Who that didn't have Chris Eccleston or David Tennant in it. I've never seen to this day, and I probably will go to my grave never seeing an episode of Doctor Who that was produced before the year 2004.
Wow,
and yet I fully understood the whole Sarah Jane episode. I didn't need the backstory. They did a great job of making sure that I got what was going on without. I didn't come away angry, feeling like I had to go watch a bunch of old Doctor Who's from the 60s to get it. And so that's our challenge too. When we've got to introduce these old characters, or if we want to hit upon old continuity, we've got to make sure we do it in a way where it's relevant to the contemporary audience.
Well, and you're doing the job right, and I appreciate that, and I know the other fans do. When Brave and Bold gets closer to its release, I'd love to talk to you more, but you've been very generous with your time, so I'll wrap up and say congrats, Mark. I mean, as always, you remain one of the more entertaining writers out there and consistently deliver with each issue and story. So thanks, and thanks for talking to us.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
A nice conversation with writer Mark Waid. Do yourself a favor, pick up Supergirl in the Legion of Superheroes on sale monthly from DC Comics. Of course, Mark's great work in 52. And if you want, reach back and get some great trades of Mark's work on characters like The Flash, JLA Year One. Also look at Top Cow's Hunter and Killer, the series that he created with Mark Silvestri, which continues monthly. And we all look forward to The Brave and Bold, Mark's take on the DCU, two characters at a time. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks so much for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, if you do check things out via iTunes or Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, they take reviews over there and votes on your favorite podcasts. If you want to vote for Word Balloon or write us a nice review, we certainly would appreciate it. Check out our MySpace, myspace.com/wordballoon. And if you ever have any questions about the show or comments, I can always be reached, john@wordballoon.com. Lots of interesting guests coming up in the weeks ahead. Just keep going to wordballoon.com for updates on upcoming episodes. Word Balloon is a copyrighted feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2006. Talk to you next time.